My mom has an MBA from Northwestern. My dad has a PhD from Northwestern.
Wow.
And when you get a traffic ticket in Chicago, they make you do an online traffic course that's through Northwestern. So I posted the certificate online, and I was like, my parents must be so proud. I'm finally joining their rank. Like, having completed 10 hours of online traffic school. Yeah, I'm also a Northwestern graduate, just like my parents. Legacy.
Congratulations.
Legacy.
Hi, I'm Philip.
Hi, I'm Matt.
First we'll have a little chat,
then put on our ring brothers.
Now it's time for Next at Bat.
And we're here today with Jill Bernard. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Matthew.
How are you?
Good.
Excellent. Jill is the board secretary at Huge Theater and the director of education. Thank you for joining us. As always, I'm here with
Philip Simondet. You almost said my name.
I did.
That would be wrong.
Then I would have cut you out for the next 22 minutes.
What's your name, Matthew McLeod?
It's Matthew McLeod. Thank you, Philip. And we'll see you a little later.
Yeah.
So, Jill, the Twin Cities Improv Festival is coming up starting this next Wednesday. Could you tell us a little bit about this festival and what you're most excited about?
It's now in its seventh year. Mm-hmm. It was started by Five Man Job, a local improv group, Lauren Anderson, Butch Roy, Nels Lennis. And every year it brings together the best of local improv and the best of national improv. So you'll get to come and see on the same bill a troupe from San Francisco or from Chicago with one of the local troupes you know and love. This year is even more special because there's so much more great local improv that it's even more just Twin Cities focused, which I just think is amazing that there's that many strong groups that Five Man Job would feel make it hold up to the national spotlight, as it were.
Yeah.
Some groups I'm excited about are Three for All, of course. They're from San Francisco. They're going to be amazing. And they're a group I saw first in Atlanta at the Black Box Festival. And I was just blown away by how talented they are. And I haven't shut up about them since. So I think Butch and Lauren and Nels finally bended to my pressure. Then the other group I'm really excited about is a duo featuring me. I guess that's self-centered. Rozowski and Bernard is going to be myself and Dave Rozowski, who's an improv legend.
Yes, he is.
He's been in a bunch of Second City shows and went on to be the artistic director of Second City LA, left there to just do kind of his own brand of improv as acting, as theater, as not some parlor trick, not something, some lesser form of theater, some ugly stepchild of theater, but he just thinks of improv as acting, and he doesn't draw a distinction between an improviser and an actor. I love that, and I love that we get to spend some time performing together and recording a podcast of our own.
Yeah.
I just talked about a podcast inside of a podcast.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool.
Excellent.
I mean, for people who've never seen an improv festival before, I don't even know how to mentally prepare you because it's just like 5 days of incredible improv, and it doesn't stop. And then there's parties every night, and you get to meet all these amazing people. And unlike a lot of other improv festivals, TCIF is always just one venue. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's other people doing shows that you're missing at the same time. It's just this one show for you, that's the best. And people come who've never been to Huge Theater before and get to see stuff that they've never seen before. People always leave the festival with such inspiration.
Right. Butch Roy, the executive director at Huge, he announced at the two-year anniversary recently that in the year prior to Huge, there were, I believe, 56 long-form improv shows, and this last year there were over 600.
I think over 500 is the math. And on his 56 long form shows, I think he was thinking specifically of professional shows.
Okay.
Because there was always Six Ring Circus at the Brave New Workshop, now the Brave New Student Union.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always a good chance to see long form, but it was student long form. It wasn't necessarily professional quality.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about like the shift that's occurred and how the whole I guess improv scene has changed since the huge effect, so to speak?
The huge effect. Well, if you think back to how it was, if you wanted to mount a show, you would either contact the Bryant Lake Bowl or a local theater that you knew had an off night. Like, people found Interact Theater and created shows there. Mm-hmm. They would create shows different places. There was never really a prime time spot to have improv, except during maybe the Fringe Festival you'd get. Yeah. There would be some improv shows there. And that was a chance to do stuff. And sort of the impulse behind creating Huge was to have a place where there would be improv every night of the week. And to know that it could be there. So you didn't have to think about it. You didn't have to seek it out. You could just wander down to Huge and know that there would be something worth seeing. Mm-hmm. The effect of that has been, I wonder if performers and groups think that Huge might be the only place to put up a show. Mm-hmm. And we look at this long term because Improv-A-Go-Go is now over 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And once Improv-A-Go-Go started, the effect was people stopped trying to produce their own shows because they had a slot at Improv-A-Go-Go. Mm-hmm. So they weren't seeking out other venues. Mm-hmm. But I think a more positive spin on the effect of Huge has been a lot of groups are getting a lot more stage time than they ever did before.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a group good. Not performing once every other month, but performing every week for an extended period of time until you develop your strengths and see what this work is like on its feet. And having this many shows has given a lot of groups a chance to kick it up into high gear quicker. I've seen people who started in our classes 2 years ago who are now in primetime Friday, yeah, Saturday shows. Mm-hmm. And that's just so quick to me. People like Casey Haig, who really started her improv career here at Huge, for her to go from a student to really very, very proficient and entertaining as hell and watchable, it so quickly, yeah, just blows my mind. And now I feel like people are in a good place to do improv anywhere. The other thing was, one of the reasons we started Huge is people to succeed in improv normally had to leave Minneapolis before. Mm-hmm. If you were very talented in the mid-90s at improv, you had to leave Minneapolis to take the next step. Part of the goal of creating Huge was to make it possible to have a full and long, healthy improv career without moving to New York or Chicago and L.A. I don't think we're done with that work because we still have a talent drain to those big locations, but I think we're a lot closer, and I also think we're becoming a really nice intermediate step. For example, if I'm a college performer in Fargo or Iowa City, I don't have to move straight to Chicago or New York. I can come to Minneapolis for a few years, cut my teeth at Huge, take some more classes, get my own opinions about improv kind of cemented, and then go off maybe to a bigger pond. I hope in the end, I mean, after all is said and done, that improv in Minneapolis will be a place you can make a career. But it's obviously that's a super long-term goal.
Yeah. Well, but you see a group like the Away Team, and there are improvisers coming here. Do you claim any credit that they're coming here because Huge exists at all? Or is it just incidental?
It's a tiny bit of both, in the sense that most of the people on the Away Team, which is an improv team, yeah, just like you said, of transplants from other cities. Most of them moved here for other reasons, family or work related. However, in the cases where somebody has a choice between two destinations, sometimes Huge, plus the Brave New Workshop, plus Comedy Sports and Stevie Ray's forming together a great, vibrant improv community, sometimes that's the tipping point in their decision. Maybe they had a choice between here and another city, and they chose us because of the improv scene to feed their soul.
There has been a lot of discussion lately about amongst improvisers about why people do what they do here versus in other cities, and I don't really want to get into the should people be paid or not. I don't want to get into that. But there is something to be said for, in Minneapolis, people aren't doing it to try to get onto Saturday Night Live. People are doing it because they want to do it. The performance is the point. What do you think that does to our community? How do you think that mentality affects our community versus someplace like Chicago, New York, LA?
There's two things that your question makes me think of. Number one, as a result, our work here has a playfulness and a joyfulness that you often don't see in other cities because, like you say, it's improv for the art itself. Mm-hmm. So we're really well known for just the pleasure we bring to the stage and transmit to the audience. The other element of it, a few years ago now, it was 2003, I saw a six-ring circus show on a Tuesday night. And then I got in a van and moved to Chicago and went to I.O. and saw a Harold Knight on a Wednesday night. And I burst into tears because the caliber of the show was identical. There was no difference in talent between the show I saw on Wednesday night and the show I saw on Tuesday night. The show I saw at the Brave New Workshop and the show I saw at I.O. in Chicago. Both featured student teams.
Yeah.
So you can't really say. But what I found and what we found whenever we send our improv teams out to the rest of the country to other festivals, maybe in Minneapolis we don't have the quantity of improvisers you find in New York or Chicago or L.A., but we certainly have the quality. We have world-class improv in Minneapolis. Maybe you don't have, 150 people doing the highest caliber work, but you have the number you need to do something really sustainable and really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I love that quality about Minneapolis improv, that it's not like you're not going to find somebody who's as talented as the people you find in the big cities.
David Brzozowski is coming to town, and he has a very distinct style that he likes to do, very detail-oriented. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah. How would you characterize Minnesota-style improv? Because I think that it's safe to say that we've kind of developed our own style over the years. Would you agree with that?
And I've hinted at it in that people describe us as joyful and playful.
Yeah.
We also have a comfort with absurdity and, I don't want to say fantasy, but fantastical elements that you often don't see in other cities. Mm-hmm. We're also stronger in the technical theater department. A lot of other cities don't use their tech booths for anything but lights up and lights down. That's something we're known for nationally. I think those are the main hallmarks that I've always gone back to when describing Minneapolis improv to people. The other element of Minneapolis improv is that we're aggressively cooperative. We really love helping each other. I think as a community, we firmly believe that a rising tide helps all ships. So we'll help each other at all costs. Like, there's a moment, and it's changed now because we gave away the chairs, but you could find the same chairs in the Brave New Workshop, Comedy Sports, and Huge Theater because they were donated to Huge. And then when Comedy Sports took the Calhoun Square space, they bought those chairs. So it just made me laugh that you could go into any of these three theaters and honestly sit in the same chairs. Yeah, they're all falling apart now. They're getting old. But yeah, it's...
And that translates into the scene work also.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
How do you think that got built in? Like, what do you think it is about the culture here that...
Well, people talk about Minneapolis nice, and they try to paint it as a negative thing, as if people are artificially nice and insincere about it. Mm-hmm. But I found it genuine. I found it to be that people here are genuinely courteous and concerned and helpful. I wrote a comedy sketch once about somebody dropping a woman trying to return a wallet to somebody who hadn't even lost one, and the other person's like, I didn't even lose a wallet. Oh, but you probably need one. the idea of I feel like I hate characterizing a whole state as one certain way, but I've met a lot of people in my time in Minnesota that are genuinely compassionately concerned about other people and want to help them. I feel like that comes across in all of the work that we do in any field. Like, that's why we're so well known for the medical sector, right? That's why the Mayo mm-hmm. Clinic is here, because people here honestly want to help and cure and help each other be happy and healthy.
When I had Drew Kirsten and Eric Heiberg on, I asked them this. If there was a universal note that you would give to improv groups that you coach or teach, what would it be?
Show up on time. Stop being late. It's unprofessional. Just kidding. No, seriously. Yeah. Show up on time. The main thing that holds improvisers back from the next level is playing small. People play very cautiously and very close to the vest, and they're afraid of how they look to others. The quicker you can get over that, the better. Mm-hmm. Often beginning classes, level one classes, have this timidity to them that's really not helpful, because the only way I can help you break a habit is if you show me that habit nice and big, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to make a mistake, I need that mistake to be nice and big so we can point at it and talk about it. I want improvisers to be able to talk about the work separate from their own ego. So when I give you a note, I'm not talking about Matthew McLeod, the person.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the improv that is in front of us. And our art form makes that more difficult. If you were a painter, we would clearly be looking at your painting and not you.
Yeah, objectively.
When we talk mm-hmm. about your art. But when I talk about an improviser's art, a lot of it feels intensely personal. So the quicker you're able to get to a point where you can just talk about improv as, talk about what we just did in a scene as the work and not as a personal attack, the more progress you will make. There's a humility to it and a courage to that that is required.
How do you think a person gets to that point where they can push that ego aside and really, like, how do you coach a person who's having a difficult time playing big?
I try to create an environment where it's hilarious when we make mistakes or screw up, so that you're not punished for it. We all have these leftover feelings of how school is when you're a kid, where if you make a mistake, you get in trouble, you get marked down, you right. get a lower grade. You have to reverse the mindset. I think it's just a culture thing that you try as a teacher to set, where if someone screws up, we can immediately laugh and stop and have fun with it. And also trying to make a mistake into a strong point. For example, if we're playing an improv warm-up game and someone plays the game technically wrong, I'm fascinated by that moment and by what happens to the rest of the group. Sometimes that moment happens and the group stops and fix them and they're like, no, it's zip, zap, zap, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the group just has a very natural inclination to take care of each other. Mm-hmm. And instead of criticizing that moment or looking sideways at the person, they just fix it and proceed. Or even better than fix it, they just celebrate that moment. Maybe it changes how the game is played. Maybe that's how they play the game from now on. And that what was originally perceived as a mistake is now our style. That's the healthiest kind of a feeling to make it so that you'll never be punished for making a mistake. I always tell students, you cannot do an improv game or exercise wrong. You can only create a new improv exercise that may not be applicable to today's lesson plan. It's impossible to do it wrong. You're just going to create something new.
Mark Sutton, that reminds me. Mark Sutton, I took a workshop with him in he said, in improv, there's no right move, no wrong move. There's only the next move.
Well, and the thing that Mark Sutton taught me that changed the way I teach improv mm-hmm. is I took a class with him that had kind of mixed levels. Like, some of us were advanced, some of us were beginners. But Mark treated everyone with the same amount of integrity and respect. He would talk to each student where they were at that exact moment He didn't give more or less notes depending on what you had done. He was able to speak directly to each student about the work they had brought to the table. That changed everything for me. Hmm. With the same amount of seriousness. And I imagine he would teach a kid's class the same way, right? I can imagine Mark talking to a 7-year-old with the same amount of professional respect.
Yeah.
That he would, I would love to see him play with his kids. I've never seen him play with his kids, but I'm sure he treats them with the same amount of dignity and respect and integrity that he would give anybody.
Mm-hmm. What is funny to you in improv?
I laugh after everyone else laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've never really completely understood why that is. Like, the audience will laugh at something funny. And then I'll laugh a half a second later at, not that it was funny, but that we were all delighted. Like, I'm delighted by the delight of the audience. It's this chain effect, if I was to analyze it. It's not because I don't find it funny. And I laugh a lot. I especially laugh a lot when I'm teaching, because I want students to know that what they're doing is funny and good. When you're watching practice scenes, you don't always react like an audience would react.
Right.
So we're all sitting there very intently watching this scene. Sometimes I have to stop and say, just so you know, an audience would have found that scene hilarious. We don't find it hilarious because we're looking at the moves and we're looking at it as a piece of work that we're chopping away at. Yeah. But an average audience would find that hilarious. I find so many things funny in improv. I mean, everything's funny to me. I try not to laugh in scenes a lot, and I do a good job with that because I invest in the character.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of it more from a character perspective. I'm on the low end of people who break up laughing in scenes. Somewhere between Harvey Korman and a rock is me. What do I find funny in improv? Like everybody, I like strong choices. So when somebody does something and it's just really strong, I'm going to laugh. I like things that don't match. Like when somebody has a high voice but a big body, that's funny. I laugh when, we all laugh when they're laughing, right? When you see a performer laugh, it's going to make you laugh.
Yeah. When it's an earned break.
Yeah.
When they just can't keep it.
It's always hilarious.
The one that kills me is Eric Noble. When he breaks on stage.
When he goes, if we're all gone.
Yeah.
There's no point.
Yeah.
It's funny. I do two different forms of improv. I do a lot of scenic improv, but I also do comedy sports. And I've played comedy sports for 20 years almost. In December, it'll be 20 years. And the comedy sports brain requires an amount of precision and adherence to comedy theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm making really smart, deliberate choices in that kind of improv. I guess that's more answering the question of what do I do to make others laugh as opposed to what others do to make me laugh.
That's fine. It's like an improv game. There's no wrong way to answer the question.
That's right. I laugh at things that are done with joy and strength. For example, I don't think I laugh harder at anyone than Lauren Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I laugh at Lauren Anderson because she's always doing something with so much heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so big and strong. And it makes me laugh because my main enemy in life is the fear that cripples us all. So whenever anyone's past that fear and able to do things that are big and bold and beautiful, people who don't even seem to know that this is when other people get afraid. People who just have a look in their eye like this is where they're happy and this is where they want to be. That makes me laugh. I also laugh at like when animals do things that people normally do, like a cat sitting on one time I came in my house and there was a squirrel sitting on the sofa And I just laughed because he was honestly, he looked like he was watching TV. He was just relaxed on the sofa. Or my friend Lynn Berg and I, this was probably 15 or 16 years ago, we saw in the grocery store parking lot, there was a dog left in a truck, but he had his head turned behind him as if he was waiting to pull out of the parking spot. That was so funny. Like, he looked like a really cautious driver because he hadn't pulled out yet. He was just really cautiously waiting to pull out of the parking spot into traffic. That doesn't really apply to I guess it applies the other way. In that I like when people play animals. I always say the mark of a Jill Bernard student is if you play a talking animal or a dead person, like that I have to high five you for. The other day, Bradley told me he played a dead animal, and I was like, yeah, you're in the advanced class now.
What excites you most about improv right now? You know, long form, being the director of education, or over at Comedy Sports, any of the above, like what's the most exciting thing to you?
I really see the rise of the next generation. Like, I'm about to turn 41, and the average improviser is somewhere between 24 and 27. So right now what's happening is the generation of improvisers behind me are really coming hard into their own. They're really now at a very advanced level. The people younger than me are not the students. They're becoming the masters. They're becoming really, really grounded in the work with a great deal of proficiency. And I find that really exciting to see the generation behind me. And the generation of improv teachers behind me as well. I started this drop-in class program. And when we first had the drop-in class, I taught it exclusively. And it was a chance to do scene work with Jill Bernard. And then I tried to find a way to teach improv teachers. I taught a short class in that. And that made me realize that that's not how you can do it. Like, the only way to learn how to teach improv is honestly to do it. Mm-hmm. So I started offering up that anyone who wants to learn how to teach improv could teach one of the drop-in classes every Wednesday from 5 to 7. And the people I've lined up to do it have, some of them have just done an amazing job teaching a really special, unique class that they designed themselves and getting their voice and their perspective out into the improv world, or at least just bringing highlights of their own education and presenting it to other people. I have this lasting fear that I'm not doing enough to cultivate and mentor the improvisers of tomorrow. They will be robots. but I do spend a lot of energy worrying about the improvisers of tomorrow. I taught improv classes at Comedy Sports from like 1997 until about 2010. And I did not do a good job of developing something that they're still using. I did not build a program at Comedy Sports in that time that they could turn around and use as a foundation. The work they're doing now is great and phenomenal, and the teachers there, like Halsey Lindquist and Michael Bruckmuller, are amazing teachers. But I didn't, in my time there, leave them with a set of tools that they could build upon, and I feel not a great regret. I don't lose sleep over it, but I feel regret that I didn't build a foundation that they could work on. Sometimes you meet older improvisers. For example, when Del Close came here and taught at the time there was a Minneapolis Improv Fest. This was 1998 or 1999, and he saw an improv troupe do the game Story. And the next day he said to us, we played the game Story in 1951 better than I saw it last night. And I wanted to say, that wasn't the same people. Like, those people who performed it last night were not the same people that you played it with in 1951. So if they're not any better at it, then really it's your fault for not having built up tools so that it could be better. So I'm conscious right now, am I leaving behind tools to build upon? And I hope that I am. So that's really what's most exciting to me, is the evidence that that's the case. Hannah Wideven is doing the youth programs at Huge. Mm-hmm. And even though I haven't, it's not like I've directly mentored her. I've shared materials with her, and I think I'm providing some sort of support to help her make those programs grow up. And like even dumb things like sharing with her a template of how you design a budget. You know, mm-hmm. here's a spreadsheet of how you design a budget when you do an improv workshop. That kind of thing is...
It's not dumb, though. No, it's not necessary. Dumb.
Yeah, it's very useful and very necessary. That's really what I want to... What I'm most excited about in improv is seeing people at a proficient level. An amazing thing happened to me last week. No, 2 weeks ago now. I took something called the Mini MBA for Nonprofits at the University of St. Thomas. Mm. And one of the speakers was talking about, I don't remember the main topic of what he was talking about, but he asked this question: what do you find fulfilling about your work in nonprofits? And it blew my mind because I had never considered that. No one had ever asked me, what do you personally find fulfilling about working at your nonprofit? I had only been exterior in my focus, only concerned about what other people are being fulfilled by through Huge Theater. And so when I sat around to think about what fulfills me, I like connecting people with ideas and resources and providing opportunities for people. So I'm most excited that Huge has provided so many opportunities for people to get on stage, do great work, meet the people they're supposed to know and supposed to collaborate with, and also get in touch with the resources that they need to be the best artists they can be. There's a really funny Onion article a few years ago about, it was a fake obituary for a woman who would have been a violin prodigy if only she'd ever picked up a violin. Just made me laugh so hard, because how many people would have, how many people would be great improvisers if the idea of improv had been introduced to them? And I feel like that's my own story. When I was in junior high and grade school, they kept putting me in gifted programs because they could tell I was somehow gifted, but it wasn't clear in what way I was gifted. I wasn't good at math or science, and I was okay at writing, and I was okay at art, but there was not a thing called improv as listed as one of the gifts you could have to be gifted. So I really felt happy when I found improv, and it seemed like everything that I'd been passionate about before then was some part of a tiny little piece of this particular discipline. So the more people we can introduce to improv who find that it is their deal, that it is their bag, I just get super happy about that.
So as the director of education, you have to be pretty excited with how the education program has grown. Could you talk just for a minute about that?
It blows my mind how quickly the Huge Theater classes have grown. We're at capacity on them right now. People keep thinking, how do you need help marketing classes? And I'm like, no, I don't. Oh, should we put out a Groupon to sell more classes? No. Every time we have a Facebook status update, someone will update the status to say, hey, classes are open now. And sometimes I have to delete it because it's like, we don't need more students. Because the thing that keeps us where we are is I always want to make sure that the teacher you have at Huge for your level of class, whether it be improv basics or scene work, is a working professional. Mm-hmm. Who is very gifted as a teacher and not just somebody who took level 5 and then turned around and started teaching level 1. Right. So the classes have to stay at a size where we can give you a quality education and not a quantity education. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm so thrilled at how much they've grown. It's unbelievable to me that like over 250 people have taken our beginner class. Like, that's a lot of people in the last couple of years.
From all walks of life, too, not just people who are interested in performing. Is that correct?
Well, what's funny is, philosophically, and I don't often mention this, but philosophically, at Huge, Our teaching staff treats every student as if we believe they will come out the other side a professional improviser. Mm-hmm. It's not, I think at some other theaters where I've taken classes or taught classes, it's just kind of to have fun, which of course is a side effect. Of course it's going to be fun. But I'm going to treat you as if you're going to be a professional so that you have that possibility. Mm-hmm. You can change your mind midway through. I think that's happened. The Brave New Workshop has an everyday track, right, and a professionals track for people who want performance track, rather, not a professionals track, but a performance track. And sometimes you'll meet someone who started in the everyday track, got caught up in the bug, and now they've joined and are doing professional.
I did that.
Stephen,
yeah.
Your example, Philip. There you go. See right there. And it, so we just philosophically from the start treat people. And I think it makes you a better teacher, because I'm never going to write anybody off. There's a big controversy over whether anyone could be an improviser. And I believe anybody could be an improviser given time and
mm-hmm.
will.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's not enough time, you know. If you're 7 years old right now and you have a heart condition, there might not be enough time on your life clock that you could become a professional improviser. If you've had a lot of things happen in your life that have made you a very walled person, we might not have time to peel all those walls down, and it might take more will or more interest than you have. But I believe anybody could be an improviser given time and will.
You and I talked the other day about how you recently were reading some things that you wrote a long time ago about improv. You've been in the game for 20 years. How has your approach to improv changed over the last 20 years?
I identified something a few years ago called the asshole phase that I think a lot of improvisers go through. When you're about 1 year to 3 years in, you figure out improv and you got this thing on lockdown, and all the oldos are just stupid. I don't even remember what year it is, but I remember leaving a comedy sports rehearsal, storming out and turning back to the room and saying, "You're stupid. You're all just stupid." And a lot of people never leave that phase, but a lot of people go through that phase. And sometimes mm-hmm. innovation happens through that phase. Like, because you think you got this on lockdown, maybe you start an improv team and that team goes on to do great things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you find a way to make peace with the old guard. Stevie Ray and I had a funny conversation. And again, I'd have to find out what year it is, like 96, where I was in this phase of like, the rules of improv don't matter, man. You don't need rules. And since then, that point of view has been refined. I'm not interested in concretely teaching the rules of improv, but I understand that what I do personally is I teach them on the back end. I sort of reverse engineer them. Like, I'd rather take the six of students and we'll work through some scene works. And then on that back, we'll say, isn't it interesting that that scene worked really well because Philip and Matthew were agreeing with each other? So instead of telling you at the start of class, improv is about agreement, I would rather that we discover it. And I've always thought, like, what if you had a room full of people and they came into class automatically yes-anding? Would you harp on that with them, or would you just work with what they're already doing? And that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I had a class 2 years ago here at Huge, or maybe a year and a half ago, and they came in the door, 12 strangers automatically agreeing and yes-anding each other. So that's one way in which I've changed. I don't think I'm as strident about the rules don't matter. And I've also learned that there are some people who are happier within a framework of teaching like that. I had a student take a couple of classes with me at Comedy Sports, and I just failed her. I could not help her understand improv. And I realized that she was the kind of person who would be happier in a program where they're much more direct about, hey, mm-hmm. here's this list of rules of improv. If you do these things, you will have good scenes. That would have given her the comfort level. And then who knows what would have happened. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find a nice way to say that to her. I think she thought I was just throwing her out of class. I was like, I am throwing you out of class, but I think you should go to Stevie Ray's and they would do a really good job helping you learn in your own learning style. Hmm. I also think and Joe Bozek helped me take note of this. Also, Jimmy Corrane and Liz Allen pointed it out for me. When I was a younger improviser, I was way too audience focused. Like, I was flirting with the audience the whole time, just making sure they thought I was funny. You know, I was just, I'd be in the scene with you, but I wasn't really, I was always looking to the side to see if you guys thought, if the audience thought I was funny. That was a very major concern of mine. And then something else too that I think maybe happens to all older improvisers is when you get into improv, sometimes it's because when you were younger, you didn't get enough affirmation. And the only thing that will make you feel loved and secure is if a room full of strangers laugh and applaud for you. And then at some point, I filled up on that, right? Like, finally, the amount of acclaim I'd received filled up the hole that my father left. And then I didn't need that kind of acclaim anymore. Or whatever, you know, whoever it was that failed me, that made me enter my 20s with this feeling that I needed, desperately needed to be loved.
I always liked the Harry Shearer quote that comedians do what they do because they want to control how they're laughed at.
Ah, that's funny. Yeah. It's really funny. And then at some, after you get through that phase of needing the love of the audience and the affirmation to feel good about yourself at the end of the night, you enter a phase where you can purely do it for the art.
Yeah.
And you enter a phase where you can just think about the improv and not about whether you're getting filled up on clapping and love and laughs. You can do it because you're very curious about experimenting in this art form. And that I was really happy to have noticed that I reached that phase.
Jill, what's the question you get asked most often in improv?
People love to interview me about the role of women in improv. It comes up a lot. There's panels. When you go to an improv festival, you'll probably have to sit on a panel of gender and improv. And it's funny that it's not a dead issue yet. And you have right. to. I've revised my answer over time. Like the main question is, why are there so few women in improv? Mm-hmm. And you can give a lot of answers to that. My most recent answer is there are the correct number of women in improv. There are just too many men. Because there's well more. There's so many improvisers. It's probably more than the market demands. But looking at that even deeper, I don't feel like it's that the women aren't strong. I feel like men are weak in a way that they don't see as a weakness. Mm-hmm. It's hard to speak in these broad generalities.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. If we're doing an improv scene together, and you're not taking in what I'm offering, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean I'm a weak improviser.
Right.
It might mean that you're a bad improviser who's not good at listening and being part of a team and collaborating, and you might be too ego-focused. I don't want to say you because it sounds like I'm talking about you.
It's okay.
I feel like the stereotypical male improviser might be too ego-focused and concerned about whether he looks funny. But if you look behind that, you'll notice that a lot of what makes an improviser funny is that their partner set them up to be funny. Mm-hmm. They say that Michael Jordan would not have been half the basketball great that he was without Scottie Pippen. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to dish you the ball for you to make a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. So, are you passing the ball? Do you have good ball passing skills, or are you a ball hog? A ball hog is not a good basketball player. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that in improv. Some people think they're great improvisers, but really they're just a ball hog who doesn't even notice the wind beneath their wings. Mm-hmm. And women are culturally attuned to be caretakers, so they're going to We're trained to, and that's why there are so many more women in the helping professions. We do honestly like helping, so we're going to set you up. You see, sometimes, and still, we've been having this conversation forever about women in improv, but you still see how sometimes the women are the ones adding the detail and the environment and the emotional content.
Well, and aggression tends to get rewarded. Not that it should, but it tends to get rewarded by laughs, whether it's uncomfortable or whatever, but by laughs, and then there are people in the audience who will come up afterwards and be like, oh, that was even though it wasn't necessarily good improv.
Right. Right. The audience doesn't know what makes the, they don't know, they can't really differentiate between what's a good improv move and what just happened to be funny. Like, they'll notice the funny thing that someone said instead of the skill that it took to craft a story. Or something along those lines.
So recently, you were one of the founders or the founder of the Tiny Funny Women Fest.
It wasn't recent. We actually founded it in 2002. But it's been something that's come and gone. When Madeline Kahn died, I think that was in 2001, people, improvisers around the world were focused on women because Madeline Kahn had been such a funny woman that some improvisers in Chicago put together the Funny Woman Festival. And then kind of as a spin-off of that, those of us that were women improvising at the time put together the Tiny Funny Woman Festival that was up here in Minneapolis. And we brought up people like Susan Messing, and we did workshops together and played together and had a great time. It was never something we consistently did. It just happened every year, every couple of years when we found time or inspiration. And then last year it really came back with a vengeance. I put it out there. I talked to the current batch of strong women improvisers about what we had done, and they took up the mantle for themselves, and we had a great weekend of workshops and shows, and it was so much fun to get to talk to people. To get to talk to other improvisers who have this thing in common that happens to be gender. Part of the reason that you'll find articles online where people say women aren't funny is because they're written by people from a different subset of society. For example, the deaf community has their own sense of humor. So if you told me a joke that was very popular among hearing impaired or deaf people, it might not strike me as funny.
Right.
The same is true of all humor. And whether good or bad, the prevailing mindset of comedy in Western civilization is from a male perspective. If you read a classified ad in this single section, when a man says he's looking for a woman with a sense of humor, he wants somebody who's going to laugh at his jokes. When a woman says that, in general, she's looking for someone who's genuinely funny. So we think of a comedy from a male perspective. So women don't seem funny because the jokes they're making aren't for you, right? So if you, like a fan of really masculine humor, don't find a woman funny, that doesn't mean she's not funny. It means you don't find her funny.
How do you think that the gender inequality can be solved? Like, what do you think that? How do you think that we, as performers, like, I mean, forget about the rest of society, but on the stage, how can gender inequality be, moved to a more equal, understandable level?
My favorite moment ever being asked this question for the 10th billionth time about about women in improv was I was at a college tournament in Boston, and one of the women asked about how do I, the men, how do I play with men on my team? And I said, well, wait till you graduate from college, because right now you're playing with boys. When you play with men, you won't have these problems. And the whole room went, oh. I was like, prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. Because adult male improvisers will always say, what are you talking about? Women aren't funny. I find women hilarious. Yeah. My wife, my girlfriend is the funniest person I've ever met. And when you watch a group that has a mix of genders, like Splendid Things, for example, mm-hmm. Hannah Kuhlman is a woman, but the way Michael Ritchie and Eric Noble play with her, it's not about that.
No.
And they cherish everything she brings to the table, everything that's masculine or feminine that anyone on the team presents. Like Michael Ritchie will do things that are incredibly beautifully feminine,
yeah.
and the team respects it. And so really it's in the casting. Are you playing with men or are you playing with boys? So as a male improviser, I would say strive to connect with that half of you, the half that is able to make emotional choices and patient choices. And as a female improviser, connect with you, the part of you that's making fast choices and bold, aggressive choices. A great improviser is an all-arounder mm-hmm. who can do all of these things. Be patient when it's needed, be fast, be emotional, be clinically hilarious. All of this should be on your tool belt.
So everyone should push to expand themselves outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah. So that you can do everything and present to us all of human experience in a single half-hour set. Right? That's probably a goal for human beings as well, off stage.
That sounds good. And now's the time in the show where we're going to throw it over to Philip Simondette for our new segment that we call Philip's Corner.
That's right. This is Philip's Corner. The smooth train that is this podcast is about to be derailed. All right. This is when Philip gets to ask questions. What do you think your IQ is?
Oh, I forgot.
Oh, do you know? You knew once?
Oh, yeah, I knew, but I don't. Maybe they didn't let me see it. That is probably okay. Somewhere between raccoon and neurosurgeon.
How wide is that gap?
I know, right?
Or raccoons?
I don't remember what numbers mean what on the IQ scale.
I don't either.
Whenever I take that Isaac Asimov's quiz in the newspaper, it says that I'm pretty smart, but I have no grind. That's pretty accurate as to my IQ. I'm pretty smart, but I've got no grind.
That'd be a good song.
Matthew, this is Philip's Corner.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Can you imagine a raccoon neurosurgeon?
There? Yes.
Who is a country singer?
Yeah.
With the song, "You're Pretty Smart, But You Got No Grind."
Yeah.
What was the best Christmas gift you ever received?
I got a Wizard of Oz Dorothy Barbie doll the same year my brothers got a Starship Enterprise bridge. So I had Dorothy from the Wizard of Oz and they had the bridge of the Enterprise so she could go through the transformer,
transporter?
Transporter, and she could like sit at Uhura Station. That was the best. Merely a hybrid of my gift with my brother's gifts.
That's fantastic.
What are you looking at?
He's getting
inspiration. Getting
words of inspiration. Okay. I improv these.
Oh my gosh.
That's why they only work half of the time, if at all.
You actually have a pretty good success rate.
Well, improv works.
No, I mean, but I bet you have an 85% success rate. 85 to 90%.
You mean of forming a question? That's not really that good.
Well, that's actually accurate. Yeah, there's 25%.
That aren't really
15%.
Sometimes you come back to the microphone and you're like, paperclip, nightgown, erase board. And you're like, that's not really a question.
Yeah, but those were all actual words.
Thank you. Oh.
So, Jill, paperclip.
Yes.
Washboard eraser.
Yes, and yes.
When you were in grade school, did they have that thing where they would make one kid like wash the board and clap out the erasers at the end of the day?
At the end of the day?
Yeah, before you could go home.
Is that what they were doing?
That's what they did at mine because it was a small private school.
I was amazingly flaky as a child. For example, I once lost the shoelaces out of the shoes I was wearing. And I would like read a book, walking down the street reading a book. So I feel like a lot of my school days are a fog because I wasn't really, I was that flaky and that scattered. All of my report cards have little hints on them, like, Jill is very silly, which you know has to be a euphemism for something, like, this kid's a mess.
Or an acronym.
Yeah, this kid. Yeah, so maybe that was happening. I don't recall.
I'll ask one more question. What is a skill that you wish you had?
I'm working very hard to learn how to speak Spanish, because that's, I would love to be able to speak Spanish. Is that a skill? I guess it is.
That's a skill.
Language acquisition. Haha, that's an actual skill. Yeah, that's what I want.
When will you know that you've achieved that?
I have an image of what fluency would look like. I would love to be able to teach a workshop in Spanish. I've tried already. It was very unsuccessful. To teach a successful workshop in Spanish and have a successful improv show in Spanish. Again, I've done an improv show in Spanish. I wouldn't call it successful, except that it happened.
Actually, I have one more question. I'm pulling a Matt McLeod. What question do you want me to ask you right now?
I want you to ask me the question, what question do you want me to ask you right now?
Perfect. That has been Phillip's Corner.
Jill, you ready to do some improv?
Oh my god, let's do some improv! Next
up, well, I like the color.
You have to taste it. You can't just look at the color. You have to taste it.
Well, I've never seen a berry that color before. I like the color. I'm just a little bit afraid. It's kind of glowing. It's kind of like a neon. Like, I really like to look at it. I'm afraid to eat it.
It's Specterberry, Ralph. It's a Specterberry.
Specter? Like a ghost berry?
Yeah, well, that's what it's named for because of the glowing quality you noted.
Well, but the locals eat it. I mean, it's safe to eat.
Boy, I've been eating Specterberries my whole life.
That's not exactly the ringing endorsement I was looking for.
I'm still alive, Ralph.
Well, it looks like barely.
Ralph, can I tell you a secret?
Sure.
That chicken you ate last night.
Oh, that delicious chicken that you prepared for me? I loved that.
There were Specterberries in the stuffing. That was Specterberry stuffing.
Oh.
And you liked it a lot.
I did like it a lot. And I feel fine today. All right, I'll try.
Go ahead, pop one in your mouth. Mm. Oh, not that one.
Mm-hmm. What?
Oh, God, I'm so sorry, Ralph. Not that one.
If you eat
one with a spot, you're marked for death.
What?
I'm sorry, Gene. You're marked for death, Ralph.
Ralph.
Oh, here comes. I'm so
Ralph,
sorry.
Ralph, I'm here to take you.
No,
it's best to just go with him.
That's not fair. I just ate a berry.
But he's floating 30 feet above you. You can't really resist that.
You ate a spotted berry, Ralph.
I didn't know.
It by choice.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know.
I assumed
Gene,
you
why
knew.
Didn't you tell me?
Well, everybody knows that. Everybody knows don't eat a spotted Specterberry. That's why they have that song.
I never heard the song. What's the song?
Don't eat no spotted Specterberry unless you want to die.
Don't
a hooded
no
scary figure comes down. I'm sorry, we're going to do a round. Hooded scary figure comes down from the sky. Take it, Specter.
Don't eat no spotted Specterberry if you're going to die.
You honestly don't know this song?
Well, actually, now that you hear it, I have heard it.
Of course.
But I thought it was metaphorical. I didn't realize that was really a thing.
I suppose when you don't know what a Specterberry is, you can't know that a song is an actual warning.
Turns out this is a true song.
Gene, I don't want to die, Gene.
Ralph, be a man.
Good point, Specter. This is what happens. Now, you're going to feel an odd feeling in your fingers and your toes.
As I pass my hand through your torso.
Oh, you're fading. Mm. Oh, you're hardly here at all.
Gene, write a book about me. I don't want people to forget. I'm not ready to die.
I'm not
Gene.
So good at writing. All right, I'll do my best.
Thanks for harvesting another one for me, Gene.
There's no problem, Specter.
I really do appreciate it.
What are you doing Thursday?
We need a new spin on this, guys. Nobody is buying these Playtex. What did Playtex make again?
Tampons.
Tampons. No one's buying them. We need a new angle.
Well, first of all, if you'd pay more attention to what our clients sold, maybe we would have come up with a better campaign before now.
I'm not a salesperson. I'm an ad man.
All right.
So Playtex whatevers.
All right.
We need a new angle. All right.
Well,
let's brainstorm this.
I know. I'm just coming from the Midwest here.
Oh, you're so folksy, Bob.
I have an idea.
All right, let's hear it.
Draw a picture for us, Bob.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just should use a dry erase board.
Oh. What? What's that supposed to?
Huh.
Huh. Well, that's a family car. That's a very traditional family car you've drawn there, Bob.
Yeah, family,
and,
that's good.
And this is the family going to get something.
Father,
can you see
daughter.
What that is?
Well, you're not a very good drawer.
No, I'm not.
Not an art major.
You should probably just tell us.
Yeah, you should just...
The whiteboard drawing idea.
I think it's time for Tampax to branch out. Get into something new. Besides
Playtex. We're doing an ad for Playtex this time.
Am I in the wrong building? I'm in the wrong building.
No, Bob. Bob, come back.
All right.
Oh, great.
Well, there goes our best ad man.
Whatever his idea was. Let's look at this.
Yeah, we just need to figure it out from this drawing you left.
Well, it's a picture of a family car with a family inside.
Are getting
something.
What
is that? What's that little?
It's little. It's about the size of a bread box.
It's not a tampon. It's a bread box.
No.
If your tampon was the size of a bread box, that'd be
bigger
very...
tampons. Maybe that was his idea. Giant tampons. One to last you a lifetime.
You're at high risk for toxic shock in that case.
Well, I'm not a...
No, you're not a...
I'm not an engineer.
Doctor.
I'm not,
you're an ad man. You
just
made
an
it
idea.
Clear.
Just
you're an idea. You're an idea man. Look at that drawing. It's a surrealist masterpiece. Maybe a cat.
That could possibly be a cat. I'll give you that.
It's a cat or a briefcase. Like a little tampon briefcase. You know, like, be serious about your tampons. If you had a tiny briefcase to carry them in, wouldn't a gal feel fresh and smart? She had a little briefcase.
Your period. It's serious business.
Oh, I like
There's
that
the tagline.
Very much. I like that very much.
Dad, can I talk to you about something?
Well, of course, sweetie.
I think I'm becoming a woman.
Oh, shit.
Well, I was wondering if I have to or if there were alternatives.
I definitely prefer if you did not.
Dad, would you be mad if I became... a Pegasus instead? Like a winged horse of ancient mythology?
I would be thrilled. I would be thrilled.
Really? You're not mad?
I'm not mad. I just don't want you to be a woman and dating all these jerk guys.
Yeah, me too.
That...
I don't want to do that. That sounds jerky.
Here, drink some more coffee, sweetie.
Thanks, Dad.
If you want to be a Pegasus, I support you completely. Just as long as you don't become a woman.
What about a female Pegasus, though?
Daryl, I'm here to pick up Rebecca.
Look, your mother's going to want you to become a woman.
Yeah, she's not going to understand.
She's not going
to
understand.
My desire to be a Pegasus.
That's right. So we're going to have to keep this between us, sweetheart, okay?
Really? Because I'm starting to bud. Bud wings.
Try to think of them as extra...
I'm getting fur in places I didn't have fur. And hooves. I'm getting hooves.
You're getting
Dad.
Hooves?
Look.
Wow.
Look at my fingers kind of fusing together. Well, to be honest, I use super glue, but that's the idea.
Your mother's not going to understand.
No. She never understands anything. Can you talk to her? Oh, he's still out there.
Daryl.
Oh.
She's still out there.
I'll talk to her. Why don't you go? Why don't you get your things?
Okay. Thanks, Dad.
Well, thanks.
Hi, Jill.
Hi. Is Rebecca ready?
Look, we need to talk for a quick minute here while she gathers her things.
Sure. Yeah. What's going on?
I have a sneaking suspicion you're trying to turn our little girl into a woman, and I will have no part of it.
What?
I've been speaking with her. We've decided Pegasus.
What?
And I know that you don't let me do a lot of the decision making anymore, but I'm putting my foot down. She's going to be a Pegasus.
Okay, first of all, I had a little girl with my husband, who was my husband at the time, so my little girl could grow up to be a woman.
I never agreed to that.
Yes, you did.
I said, let's have a baby. Girl, good. Not okay with the woman part.
That was like a tacit acceptance when you had a baby girl. That you were going to have a woman eventually.
You can't lawyer this daughter. Out of me, Jill.
There was no Pegasus on the table at the time. Plus, you know I'm allergic to horses. This is just like you.
Well, maybe she'll have to come spend the weeks with me and only the weekends.
Oh, now it comes out. You're not going to get away with this. See, first of all, like you always get her a better present on Christmas and her birthday. You're not going to give her more love than me. This is not going to happen. She's going to be a woman like she's supposed to be, and she's going to be gorgeous.
Don't I get any say in this?
Of course you do, sweetheart. And she wants to be a Pegasus, I'll have you know.
I want to be a Pegasus,
sweetheart, you're 12. You don't know what you want.
I want to be a Pegasus.
You know, everybody at your age wants to be a Pegasus or a pony.
Can I come?
Come show your mom your hooves.
Sure, you can come in.
Look what.
Look at my
hooves. Oh my God.
Look what a beautiful Pegasus our daughter is
becoming.
That
is super glue. What did you let her do?
I let her do whatever she wants on the weekends when she's here. I barely watch her.
Oh my God, what does she have glued to the back of her head?
It's my mane.
That is a mop head.
Get it.
It is a mop head.
I'm flying free in the breeze.
That is her beautiful Pegasus mane.
My beautiful mane.
And she has cardboard sewn on her back? How
for
did she
now
get it sewn?
Budding.
I don't know.
I'm budding. Wings.
Daryl, how did she get it sewn to her back?
Mom, I know how to sew.
But
I'm not stupid.
How do you sew on your back?
I have very flexible arms. Mom.
I feel like you may have had an accomplice in this.
Mom.
Yes?
Are you saying you wanted to be a Pegasus when you were 12, but something happened to change your mind?
Who didn't want to be a Pegasus when they were 12?
What happened to change your mind, Mom?
My parents talked me out of it.
Don't you wish they hadn't?
Some days, but then I look at you and I'm glad that I was a woman.
Won't you be happier looking at me if I'm flying high above you? Or perhaps offering you a ride?
No, because...
Through the sky?
Someday you'll be able to have your own little girl.
Philly. My own little filly, Mom.
Own little girl.
Why would you crush our daughter's dream the way that your mother crushed yours, Jill?
Because then you can have your own family.
Then I can have what?
Your own family.
We'll have my own family, Mom. It'll just be a Pegasus family.
How many boy Pegasus do you know?
Well, once I'm up in the clouds, I'll get to meet some. Right now on Earth, I can't meet any, but once I'm high above Mount Olympus.
Everybody knows there are no boy Pegasus.
What?
I didn't know that.
Everybody knows
it. I didn't
it.
Know that.
It's true.
Oh, wow. That kind of changes things.
It does.
Well.
Well, sweetie, you still want to be a... Don't be a woman, right? Still be a Pegasus.
Yeah. I want to be a Pegasus.
But you can't have
I'm
going to
sacrifice for my career. I'm going to sacrifice family for my career.
What career? What career is the
Pegasus?
You're 12.
You know that
you don't get to make decisions, and neither do you. You're a once a month dad.
He's the best dad.
He's the best once a month dad.
I let him do whatever she wants when she's here.
Better than Carlton. Mom's dating a guy named Carlton. He's so gross.
From the grocery store?
Yes, from the grocory store.
Oh. He has a beard.
I was going to tell you, but then you brought up Pegasus.
Pegasi?
You say it your way.
Hey, what's in your briefcase? What's in your... Can I look in your briefcase?
Why do you want to know? Why do you want to know? Why do you want to look so bad?
What's it? Maybe I'm neighborhood security. You're not from here. Let me look in your briefcase.
Maybe I'm from here and you just never met me.
I never met you before. Did you just move? What's in your briefcase? Did you just move in here?
Maybe you should just look over in that direction.
Suit. What?
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, keep looking over there because you don't need to look at my briefcase.
What? Holy shit, man. How are you doing that? How are you doing the moonwalk without moving your feet? What are you? Are you magic?
I'm Kansan.
No way.
Yeah, man. Totally Kansan.
I I never met a Kansan.
Nobody has.
What
Think
the?
About it.
How are you doing that?
Do you know anybody from Kansas?
No, not till now.
Yeah. We can all do that.
Oh, man. We should get that hat. How's it?
Where do you think? Watch this.
Whoa! It took off that lady's blouse. Sorry, lady. I was just watching his hat.
Hey, sorry about that. I was just doing a demonstration.
Sorry, lady. Give her blouse back, man.
Oh, yeah. Here you go.
Wow, your hat buttoned her blouse up for her. That's amazing, dude.
Yeah. There are a lot of things that my hat can do.
Is there secret Kansas stuff in your briefcase?
Try not to worry about my briefcase, okay? But do you want to see something really cool?
Yeah.
Okay, watch my hand.
I'm watching it.
Okay. Now.
Whoa! You got dolphins for fingers at will! Are they real dolphins?
Yeah.
And they're just your fingers?
They're having a convention right now.
What the... That's insane, dude.
I know. And back to normal.
Now they're just regular fingers. As if they were never dolphins at all. Kansas sounds crazy, man.
It's pretty rare that any of us leave that state.
You had to come here? Seek shelter? Is Kansas in trouble? I will help you, my Kansan brother.
Okay, that's what I was looking for.
There you are.
Oh, Arkansan.
No way.
From Arkansas.
I've been looking for you, Kansas.
My God, his legs are made out of grain. How's he walking around on grain legs?
Special Arkansas skills. Don't worry about
it. Well,
use this lens. You can see into his brain. And you can see that there's nothing there.
There's nothing there. It's just spacious. Like an unrented banquet hall.
I'm here for the briefcase, Kansas.
Yeah, well, you're not going to get it.
Well, yeah, check this out.
Oh, my God. It's like a pitchfork, but grosser.
Do with that, Kansas.
Stop. Let it go. Your hat hit his pitchfork head.
You're less of a person.
Take my briefcase here.
Oh, man, so much responsibility so early.
Come.
Thank God Illinois is filled with these sewers of safety.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I love it. It's like, how do you come up with that? It's like, oh my God. If I were you, I would start a blog. Because you just always say the best things, and I would read it.
No, that's my honest diagnosis. You have leukemia.
That is rich. That's just rich. Like, oh, I love it. Like, that's the worst thing that you could say. That's like funny. That's
doctor,
hilarious.
Do you want me to get a psych counsel? Because I don't think that.
I think maybe you should.
Okay, I'll go do that.
Thank you.
So leukemia, like the leukemia. Oh, yeah, that's.
Yes. I don't.
You're in the wrong profession. I am serious. You should do stand-up.
No one's ever said that I'm funny before. I'm not genuinely funny.
I would disagree. Tell me some of the other jokes you told the other patients today.
I've never told anyone a joke. I did tell someone that their T count had actually lowered.
Their T suck out? Lowered? So like they would be very ill then.
It's not.
They would be unable to cure themselves.
I don't know why you find that.
There should be a sitcom. This is sitcom material. The funny doctor. I love it. I love it.
Is there a member of your family that you'd like
Hey, brother. How are you?
Check out this joke Doc just told me. Doc,
what's up, Marlon?
Doc, tell him.
Say it again. I had to tell someone that their T cell count was actually lower.
Right.
It's not a joke.
It's like, what? How are they going to drink their tea then?
You're his brother then?
Yeah. Why? What's going on?
Well, Stephen has. Would you like me to tell him?
Yeah, yeah. No, my comedic timing is terrible. You go.
Your brother Stephen has leukemia.
You're right.
That's not funny.
It's like the worst thing she could say. No, that's what's funny.
But her delivery is amazing.
Right? Yeah,
I'm not trying
right?
to be
like
funny.
Chris Rock over here.
I'm trying to let you keep you abreast of your medical condition. I'm not trying to. I'm trying to be funny. You have lots of choices. We'll have a site visit.
I'm looking.
Yeah, site visit.
Can I answer? You know, are there any answers you'd like to? Any questions you may have?
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
I have a question. How
funny are you?
Right.
I'm not actually. No one has ever said I'm funny before. In fact, I didn't even.
Do you take this job because you're like naturally hilarious?
Quite the opposite. I was driven to math and science in high school because everyone found me very unfunny in the theater classes.
You're never off. You're just always on all day. And so, man.
You're like Stephen Wright. You remember Wright. Stephen Wright?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just trying to give you information about your condition and your brother's.
It's like a combination of condition. Delivery and accent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that weird accent. Yeah.
I hadn't perceived myself to have any particularly strong.
She could say anything accent. And it would be a little bit funny, but also she's funny.
Can you just read this page of the phone book I brought with me?
Do you just carry on?
That's his favorite page. Yeah. It's a good section.
Anderson Claude 612-34. Gentlemen, are you okay? You're coughing.
I'm sorry. Emphysema. I'm sorry. Can you say it?
That's an old joke.
You have emphysema? I don't see how that's funny.
Caitlin, you brought me gold, but I need you to get back out there and try to get me like a nice feel good piece too.
I, Chief, can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm cut out to be a journalist. So much.
Don't know if you're cut out for it.
I don't know if I'm cut out to be a journalist.
You were born for this job.
I don't know, Chief. It's just that I find the interviews so awkward.
But you're such a natural with people. You make them feel comfortable and you have no problem coming up with questions. You listen so well and you're sharp.
It's just I don't know if you ever listened to the recordings of any of my interviews, like the interviews recordings that I've given you, but interview subjects tend to be very mean to me. Like, let me play you back. You know that story I did on the city council?
Yeah.
Let me play you this recording of my interview with the mayor.
Sure.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to ask you some questions about
absolutely.
The,
yep.
About the recent city council
Could you speak up a little bit?
I'm sorry. I'm speaking up. I'd like to ask you some questions about the recent city council elections.
Mm-hmm.
It seems more members of your party are now on the city council.
Could you get to the point, please?
I'm sorry. How does it feel to have people on your team on the city council? Do you think you'll get more passed?
Well,
resolutions?
We'll always will. That's a dumb question. That is a stupid question. Maybe it's just your face that makes it seem so stupid.
Mayor, there's no need to.
There are real.
Mayor, that's completely unnecessary. That's completely unnecessary. Ow.
No, if I can slap some sense into you, I will.
Ow. Mayor, please.
Go back to that stupid newspaper of yours and send a real reporter.
Ow.
Send a real person.
See, Chief, I don't know if I want to do it anymore.
But you got such a good story out of it, and you made him sound so sympathetic at the same time.
Well,
let's hear the story you did with the local football team.
Well, let me change the cassette.
Here's the recording, sir. So, Johnny Altman, you're the football quarterback.
Duh, yeah, duh.
How is the game? How do you feel about...
We won. What more do you want?
That's true. You did win, but were there any crucial plays that you really thought ensured your video, your victory?
It's the stupidest question I've ever been asked. You kidding me? What kind of sports columnist are you? Is this like your first time asking about sports? Stupid.
I know. Critical play. The City Hall.
Somebody needs to slap some sense into you. Get off of the field. I'm going to punt you.
So you see, Chief, every interview seems to go really badly. I don't know if I want to be a journalist anymore. After that record, the tape recorder was crushed, which is why you don't hear when the entire team sacked me as if I were the opposing quarterback.
See, now that's not how I heard that interview at all. What I heard was an entire football team opening up to a really good reporter who had insightful questions and an ability to draw out candid answers.
Chief, I just don't know if I can physically take it. I don't... Maybe I need a gentler beat. Like where... meeting with people who aren't so physically strong.
Well, let's listen to this tape where you were interviewing the town's oldest woman.
Mrs. Sophie Long, you are 103 today. How does it feel?
You look stupid!
Chief, that's when she shot me in the leg. It really didn't go as well as my piece made it seem. It didn't really go that well.
Well, to be fair, you made her sound terrible.
Well, she did shoot me in the leg. I don't know, Chief. I don't know.
And that's our show. Thank you to Jill Bernard for being our guest today. You can find Jill over at Huge Theater. That's Huge Theater in Uptown Minneapolis on the corner of 31st and Lindale, where she is the board secretary and the director of education. She also performs regularly at Huge on Monday nights with Show X, which gets together some of the best improvisers in the Twin Cities. She's also going to be performing at the Twin Cities Improv Festival this coming Saturday, the 29th, with Dave Rozowski in Rozowski and Bernard. That time slot will also include the Gay Straight Alliance, so that slot will definitely be selling out. Make sure you get your tickets soon. Find out more information about Jill and the Twin Cities Improv Festival and Huge Theater at the following websites. Facebook.com/Jill-Bernard, TwinCitiesImprovFestival.com, and HugeTheater.com.
And sign up for the Huge mailing list. They send out once a month a little update on what's going on at the theater. And there's also a great Ask Jill section where she will answer your questions, and it's awesome. Check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Philip Simondet. I've newly organized it so that you can find dirty and clean songs and know which are which before you get in trouble at work. And also Minimum Fare,
which is his video podcast, which includes a lot of local improvisers. And if you're interested in being on Minimum Fare, make sure you get a hold of Philip. He's always looking for new people to be on.
That's right. Some of the places you can get a hold of me, other than just Facebook, are the Next at Bat Facebook page. Search for Next at Bat, or through email, nextatbatpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on iTunes. Rate, review, and subscribe to us. Leaving reviews and rating us really helps us out, so please do that.
Thanks for listening, and hail Jaibosh.